Good morning. Well, our goal this quarter has been to help me believe God exists. And I don't know how you can really help someone believe God exists in our culture today without addressing what for some people is the elephant in the room. It's evolution. For a lot of people, that's one of the reasons they claim they don't believe in God is because of evolution. And so I want to take some time to think about that with you here today, tonight. I'll be back with you again in a couple of weeks, and we'll think about it one last time that Sunday morning. In college, I majored in English education. And before acquiring my teaching license, I had to spend my final semester of school student teaching on the high school and the middle school level. And a week before I arrived to Zionsville High School, which is a high school right outside of Indianapolis, I was given the text that I was required to teach by my supervising teacher. It was a play titled Inherit the Wind. And I was supposed to portray, it's supposed to portray the famous Scopes monkey trial where William Jennings Bryan and Clarence Darrow go head to head to discuss whether or not Darwinian evolution should be taught in the public schools of America. Now, of course, like most entertainment today, the play is sympathetic to Darwinian evolution, and it aims to make creationists look backwoodsy and foolish. And so it was a difficult assignment for me. I was preaching at the time. It was a difficult assignment for me to teach. After all, if I rejected teaching it, I ran the risk of failing my student teaching course. If I taught it, I ran the risk of leaving a false impression of the creation-evolution debate on my students. And so I rolled up my sleeves for a couple of days and tried to figure out how am I going to teach this text without inserting religious views and still influence the students in a better direction. And so here's what I did. We not only read the play and watched it, we also read the actual historical trial. I taught my students how to decipher between real history and fiction, and also asked them to consider point of view, such as the bias that some authors might have. I still taught the play, also taught a little bit of history. And at the end of those 2 weeks of study, I had a couple of students thank me for teaching in that fashion. They said this actually helped them increase their faith, to see the difference between real history and someone's entertaining portrayal of it. So they were refreshed to see a teacher who wasn't trying to indoctrinate their students with just evolution. I don't think I impressed my supervising teachers much with that. After I taught this, I also taught some of the works of Sophocles in a senior AP class. One of my supervising teachers warned me that my methods could cause the school to be sued. I should avoid any religious teaching. Mind you, I never quoted the Bible once. I only asked questions using the text that I was given to lead the students to critical thinking and conclusions, but it was pretty clear I hadn't passed my supervisor's test. I didn't get a recommendation. It's all right, I'm preaching now. So it didn't matter. So there. But I'm glad I had the experience. It taught me something. I learned a little bit about our educational system and the bias that it promoted and taught in favor of evolution. I also learned that the argument for evolution is not always accurately represented. That play would be one instance of it, but also some of your science textbooks are evidence of it. I'm going to give you some examples today of some blatant misrepresentations. I don't even have time for all of them. Of some fraudulent claims, some false evidence that are often given in favor of evolution. And some of it was used when you were a student. Some of it was used when I was a student. Some of it has since been overturned and yet is still in current science textbooks. And it's sad to think that there are some common fraudulent examples that we're going to share today that have shipwrecked the faith of many young minds, misled people. Now you might ask, well, why is this important to me? Well, I think we explained that in our first couple of lessons this year. If you want to go back and check them out, young people are leaving the church. And one of the reasons often given, there's a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons often given is their belief in evolution. But if you want a Bible verse, here's one. 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 9. The coming of the lawless one is apparent in the working of Satan, who uses all power, signs, lying wonders, and every kind of wicked deception. Satan's goal is to deceive us. For those who are perishing because they refuse to love the truth. If we don't love the truth enough, we may be fair game to be deceived. It says, for this reason, God sends them a powerful delusion. There are some people who are deluded. God allows Satan to work, and we might be deluded by him, and we might be led to believe what is false. Your King James probably says to believe a lie. I don't want you to believe a lie. And the fact of the matter is, when I was in high school, I got taught some lies. And some of those lies are still being taught today. And it's our job to protect people from those lies. From being deceived, from being deluded. It says some, all who have not believed the truth but took pleasure in righteousness will be condemned. We don't want people to be condemned. We don't want them to be deluded or taught a lie. And I want you to think about a few ways in which Satan deceives us, and we are deceived by looking at some of these examples today. One of the first things that happens sometimes with the evolution discussion is this. One of the first problems is that educators, scientists, and I'm not putting all educators in this category. I'm not putting all scientists in this category. I hope you understand that. There are some, and so we're just using that term broadly. But they oversimplify the positions, specifically the terminology that gets used. Dr. Jonathan Sefardi, in this book, Refuting Evolution, he says, evolutionists call all change in organisms evolution. He says, however, creationists have never disputed that organisms change. The difference is the type of change. And a key difference between the two models, that is the creationist model of evolution and the Darwinian model of evolution, is whether observed changes are the type that turn particles into people. Does that happen? Let me give you a couple of examples of the oversimplification that occurs. First of all, we can oversimplify what evolution means by the definition. This is from a local biology textbook that I got from a local science teacher, and it defines evolution as, this is the textbook that's being used today in high schools around here. It defines evolution as cumulative changes in groups of organisms through time. Well, okay. If we're just using that definition, by the way, it's pretty easy to prove that evolution occurs. Because after all, organisms do change over time. I want to also note with you, though, what some textbooks say about the creationist position when it comes to evolution, because sometimes they oversimplify and exaggerate and don't define creationist position very well. One science textbook said this, creation science states that all species were created by God roughly 10,000 years ago and that they have not evolved since. And as scientific issues, we know that these assertions are false. Look, that's not what I believe. And that's not what most creation scientists I know believe. And so that argument set up by evolutionists is a straw man argument. It's defeating a position that creationists do not hold and certainly is not scientific. What position do creationists hold? Well, you got to look at the Bible and I think we can find out what position I hold. The Bible teaches that life originated with God, but it never gives a date. And so when you put a date, 10,000 years, I don't like to put a date because, you know what, God never did. Life originated with God. Genesis 1 and verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. We've explained that in our cosmological argument that something doesn't come from nothing. And so we need to have a supernatural to explain that since we know scientifically it doesn't happen. And the Bible does provide that explanation for us that God created the heavens and the earth. The Bible teaches that God created kinds. When people say that creationists believe God created all species and creationists don't believe that, you know, that there's any change. No, God created kinds, not species. The word species is not used in Genesis 1, 11 and 12, and in Genesis 1, verse 21, or in Genesis 1, verse 24, the word kinds is. It's not the word species, and it's a different word. Look at verse 11. God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seed, the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its kind. Verse 12. The earth brought forth grass, the herb that yields seed according to its kind. The tree that yields fruit whose seed is in itself according to its kind. Okay? Same thing can be said in verse 21 when you talk about the sea creatures and the animals. And then in verse 24, let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind. Cattle, creeping things, beasts of the earth, each according to its kind. And so God created kinds, not species. Noah, when he collected animals for the ark, he didn't collect every species. The Bible doesn't say that. It says that he collected kinds in Genesis 6, 19, 20. Now these kinds reproduce similar kinds, which allows for variation of species. And let me tell you the word that gets used for that. It's microevolution. And microevolution is biblically acceptable, and it is observable in science. Let me give you an example of that from Darwin. Darwin observed microevolution. He observed the finches on Galapagos Island, which is one of the most common examples, and he noticed that some of those finches' beaks might get bigger and some of them might get smaller than others over time. Here's what Darwin never observed, but he tried to prove from Darwin's finches that I don't agree with, that it's not biblical. Darwin never observed his finches evolving from fishes or turning into foxes. He never observed one kind changing into another. That's not observable science. It is not biblical, and it is not scientific. That moves into the realm of speculation. Microevolution is biblical. There are changes within kinds. Corn produces a variety of corn. You can produce sweet corn and hybrid corn and Indian corn, but you can't produce animals from corn. Dogs produce a variety of dogs. You can have poodles and mini poodles and golden doodles and labradoodles, but you're not going to get a fish from that poodle. You can get a variation within the kinds, but you're not going to get macroevolution. You're not going to observe it. So macroevolution, change from one kind to another, is not biblical, not observable by science. And so we need to define what we're talking about when we talk about evolution properly, and what we would oppose and what we would maybe agree with could be biblical. So that's what we dispute. In fact, if you take a look at Jacob and his breeding of the sheep when he was dealing with Laban, there's an example of variation within kinds. Jacob understood there was variation within kinds in Genesis chapter 30. And used it to his advantage with his shepherding business there. What we do dispute as unscientific and unobservable is goo to you, particles to people, a change in kinds type of macroevolution. That's not observable in nature. And it defies the Bible and the scientific process of reproduction. So it's important to distinguish the fact that if we oppose a specific type of evolution that's found in our secular school textbooks as required by state standards, we need to get the definitions right. Now, you might say, well, I thought evolutionists had proof for believing that we all descended from a common ancestor. And so now that it's clear what we oppose, take a look at some of the historical proofs that are used for the theory of macroevolution, and that's what I mean when I use the term evolution from here on out. Let's look at some of the things that are used for the theory of macroevolution and consider the fact that some of the most famous oft-published evidence is truly a hoax. This is Stanley Miller's experiment that you might find in some of your local textbooks. Do you remember studying this when you were in biology? I do. We talked about Stanley Miller. It's still in the biology textbooks today. This image here was found on the University of Miami's biology site. There are universities that still use Stanley Miller as an example. It's found in most high school science textbook as proof of chemical evolution, which they claim would be the origin of life. This site states, as you can see there in the image, that Stanley Miller created the basic building blocks of life in his 1953 experiment. So this is proof. We don't need a God. We've learned that we can naturally just make these things happen. And it's used as that. Take a look from the local biology textbook. It says in 1953, American scientists Stanley Miller and Harold Urey, they were the first to show that simple organic molecules could be made from inorganic compounds as proposed by Oppert and Haldane. Miller and Urey, hold on, I want you to think about this for a minute. Miller and Urey build a glass apparatus. Hold on, what'd they do? They built something. Wow, that sounds like design. But this is all natural, right? They built a glass apparatus to simulate the early Earth conditions hypothesized by Oprah. And they filled the apparatus. Hold on, what'd they do? Didn't happen naturally. They filled the apparatus with water and certain that they thought had made up the early atmosphere. Now, this is used as proof, right? Proof that we can get life from non-life. Goes on to say, the water was boiled. Hold on, what'd they do? They did something to the water themselves. This didn't happen naturally. The water was boiled. Electric discharges, where'd that electric come from, were used to simulate lightning as an energy source. And upon examination, the resulting mixture contained a variety of organic compounds, including amino acids. We still don't have a cell, by the way. Not even a simple cell yet. We just have the amino acids, which are not cells. But they found some amino acids, and because amino acids, listen to the jump in logic here, because amino acids are the building blocks of proteins, this discovery supported the primordial soup hypothesis. Goo to you can happen. We can all come from that primordial soup. It can happen naturally. Here's some problems with this. Did Stanley Miller's experiment provide evidence for non-life to life? There's several problems. First of all, where'd that prebiotic soup come from in the first place? You don't get to start with stuff, okay? If you're trying to simulate where it all came from, you get to start with nothing. He started with something. We've already got a problem there. Second, he used the raw materials. This is from Science Magazine in 1995. Remember, that experiment was in 1953. 1995, the early atmosphere looked nothing like the Miller-Urey simulation. Most people would state today that what he was using to start with, which, where'd he get it from, but what he was using to start with looked nothing like the early atmosphere. Third, Miller's experiment was conducted under the wrong conditions. He's got simulated lightning. Where does lightning come from? You have to have certain things existent in the atmosphere to get lightning. Where does he get the lightning from? He isolated the elements in the right temperatures. Again, if you isolate the elements in the perfect temperatures so that hopefully you can get amino acid out of it, that's not nature. You're not proving Darwin's theory of natural selection with that. You're not proving these things to naturally happen. You're proving design. That somebody had to be behind this and design this to make it work perfectly. Fourth, here's the other problem. Miller found the wrong results. He never came close to a single cell. All he created was amino acids, the building blocks of protein. However, in order all that to happen, you've got to have both right-handed and left-handed amino acids. And he had right-handed and amino acids in the mixture, and that makes up a poisonous mixture. If I was to continue reading the science book with you, it would use the word cyanide. I've got the science book in my office if you want to see it. But you know what cyanide is? It's poison. You don't get life from cyanide. And yet the assertion that is made in the textbook is this is proof that we could have all come from a primordial soup. A poisonous primordial soup is proof that we came naturally from these things? His experiment proved nothing. This is Jonathan Wells, Berkeley-educated doctor, and he writes in Icons of Evolution. And I encourage you to read this book. Give it to every science teacher you know. But he says, the 1953 Miller-Urey experiment generated enormous excitement in the scientific community. It soon found its way into almost every high school and college biology textbook, still in college biology textbooks today, as evidence that scientists had demonstrated the first step in the origin of life. Yet for more than a decade, he wrote this in 2000. For more than a decade, most geochemists have been convinced the experiment failed to simulate conditions on the early Earth, and thus it has little or nothing to do with the origin of life. And yet still in the textbooks, you're being lied to. You know why they haven't inserted anything else in there to replace this? Because there is nothing. They don't have any proof that you can get life from non-life. Nobody has made it happen yet. It's just not there. This is from Michael Behe, a biochemist who writes in Darwin's Black Box about clause dose. He's quoting an Origin of Life researcher, and he says that clause dose says, more than 30 years of experimentation on the origin of life in the fields of chemical and molecular evolution have led to a better perception of the immensity of the problem of the origin of life on Earth rather than to its solution. In other words, we've been studying this, and we still have a problem. We still can't prove it. At present, all discussions on principal theories and experiments in the field either end in stalemate or in a confession of ignorance. I don't know how it happened. Well, no, not if you try to explain it naturally. This is Lee Strobel's book, The Case for Faith, where he deals with one particular issue in his chapter about why people are struggling in their faith, and science is sometimes the issue. He says, Dr. Walter Bradley, he speaks of the odds of randomly assembling a protein molecule, which is what the Stanley Miller experiment is supposed to prove. The odds for all practical purposes are zero. That's why even though some people who aren't educated in this field still believe life emerged by chance, scientists simply don't believe it anymore. Well, here's a third thing that I want you to think about, a third thing, and that's the geologic column. And we could talk so much more. We could do an entire lesson on every single one of these things. So if you feel like I'm skimming over some details, we can talk about it more. I can give you a lot more things to read. But the geologic column, do you remember seeing this in your science textbooks? It's still in science textbooks today. And it's an evolutionary myth. Do you notice that this isn't a picture of an actual stack of rocks here? This is an artistic representation. I want to tell you, when it comes to science, anytime you see someone offering an artistic representation rather than something real, you should be a little cautious. This is artistry. You can fake artistry. You can lie through artistry. This is what's in most books, though. This is the geologic column. Now, this column, I want to tell you who created it. It was first created in 1830 by Charles Lyell. Charles Lyell was an atheist, trying to prove that there was no God, and his assumption when it came to the rock layers, the layers that we see, and we talked about this in our Noah's Ark lessons in our adult Bible class, but his assumption with the rock layers was that those rock layers formed slowly over millions of years. Do you remember getting taught that when you were in science class? I do. Anybody, nobody else did? I'm just the only idiot in here who had... All right, I see a hand. All right. Darwin based some of his ideas on Lyell's book, Principles of Geology. Remember, Darwin's Origin of Species comes out in the 1850s. Lyell was actually pre-Darwin in 1830. And Darwin bases some of his ideas on this book. Now, in Ohio, by the way, the state requires science teachers to teach uniformitarianism. It's in the state standards. Go look it up on their website. I looked it up this week. And that's what you're supposed to teach with regard to how rock layers formed. No, none of this nonsense about Noah's Ark and this great cataclysmic flood and all of that. You need to teach that the reason why we have rock layers is just slowly, because the Earth is millions and billions of years old, that those rock layers just inch by inch, over thousands and millions of years, just have slowly risen. Uniformitarianism was what Lyell popularized, okay? Uniformitarianism can, and this is a quote from the Ohio Standards, uniformitarianism can be an important key in understanding how scientists have interpreted the environmental conditions that existed throughout Earth's history. Fossil evidence can indicate specific environments and climate conditions that help interpret the geologic record. Okay? So, it's taught. There's several problems with the geologic column. Let me go through a few of them with you. Problem number one, it's created in 1830 based on an assumption. It's an assumption. We're not supposed to assume in science. But the assumption is uniformitarianism. Let's slowly, rock layers form over millions of years. By its assumption, it rules out the most likely cause of rock layers that are filled with fossils. which should not be slowly just a pile of dust here this year and a pile of dust here and a pile of dust here, and just over millions of years it just kind of piles up. The reasons why we have fossils, that is imprints of actual physical living beings in rock layers all over the earth, was not because that animal laid there and just over thousands of years the dust piled up over them. Catastrophism. There's some catastrophe. There was something massive that occurred that encased that animal or that insect or whatever it is, or that shell, in mud and quickly encapsulated it as the mud hardened and captured the imprint or the actual bones of that animal in rock. And so, the first problem is an assumption. There's other assumptions we could use, but that's the assumption we use because it's an assumption that rules out what God's Word says about how those rock layers might have formed. The second problem is that fossils or rock layers don't come with dates. Did you know that? When you pull a fossil out of the ground, did you know there's not a date on it? Now, you go to any museum, you go to the zoo, you go to a lot of those places, and they're going to tell you this is millions of years old. That rock never came with a date. You can assume that all you want, but that's another assumption. They don't come with dates labeled to the rock, despite scientists' effort to label dates because that helps push their evolutionary ideas. I like this comic. This fossil is 3 billion years old. He asks, how do you know? He says, it's in this rock strata. Oh, well, how can you be certain of the age of this rock strata? Because this 3 billion-year-old fossil was in it. That's what we call circular logic. Okay? Problem number three. Across the world, petrified upright trees are buried throughout the rock layers. Here's some examples. Just type in polystrate fossils and you can find lots more examples. But all over the world, there are petrified upright trees buried throughout the rock layers. How'd they get there? Just slowly over millions of years, the dust kind of piled up over the trees and encased them. Is that how that happens? It's not how it happened with Mount St. Helens, 1980, when that volcano exploded and there's petrified trees all over the state of Washington around the volcano. We know how it happened there. Problem number four. The Cambrian explosion ruins the idea of a slow process of evolution up to the present day. Here's the thing. When you look at Cambrian rock, most major animal phyla are found in Cambrian rock. And that occurs without any of Darwin's assumed links. The Darwinian theory, the tree of life, that's also a picture you see in the science books, is that we all descended from a common ancestor and then we just branched out and became other things. What you see in the fossil record is actually the biblical pattern. You see various kinds all of a sudden in Cambrian rock, and the fossils take very much the same shape and form that they do for people today, without any of Darwin's assumed links, which is another major problem for Darwinism. There's no transitional links. And so that's problem number five with the geologic column. Despite millions of fossils, we find no evidence of intermediate transitional links between animals. This is from David Ropp, who writes, he's a paleontologist, he writes in Evolution of the Fossil Record. In the years after Darwin, he says, his advocates hoped to find predictable progressions. In other words, if we had fish who turned into frogs, who turned in eventually to, you know, animals that walked on fours and then eventually turned into people who walked on two, or apes who turned into people, we'd expect to see those transitional fossils, right? And we don't find it. Ropp says, the optimism has died hard and some pure fantasy has crept into textbooks. Stephen Jay Gould, he's an evolutionist, by the way, but he says this, most species exhibit no directional change during their tenure on Earth. They appear in the fossil record looking much the same as when they disappear. He's not a believer, but he admits, we don't really have the proof on our side when it comes to this. Stephen Jay Gould was the director of the Museum of Natural History in Chicago for a long time. He's passed away now. He wrote quite a bit on some of these things. Darwin once stated in his Origin of Species, he says, intermediate links? He said, geology assuredly does not reveal any finely graduated organic chain, the tree of life. He says, geology doesn't reveal it, and this perhaps is the most obvious and serious objection which can be urged against the theory. Well, absolutely, Darwin. You're right. They're not there because it's not how God made things. David Rapp, the curator of the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago, he said, we are now about 120 years after Darwin, and the knowledge of the fossil record has been greatly expanded. We have 250,000 fossil species, but the situation hasn't changed much. We have even fewer examples of evolutionary transition than we had in Darwin's time. So what's the point here? The picture that you see in the geology textbooks of the geologic column is not the one you see in the rocks. It's an artistic representation. Now, here's what somebody might say. Well, what about Archaeopteryx, right? What about some of those fossils that we see in some of the textbooks? Do you remember seeing maybe this guy in a textbook at some point? The pressure is high because if you want to prove that goo to you happens, that, you know, apes turn into men and that we came from fish, you got to find some of those fossils in the fossil record. And so the pressure is on. Evolutionists need to produce some transitional fossils. And because of the pressure, there's been a lot of forgeries that have been produced. And here's one of them. In a 1999 article in National Geographic magazine, there was a combo dinosaur bird Archaeoraptor that was noted there. What's wrong with this bird? Well, just let this scientist say, someone had glued a dinosaur tail to a primitive bird. It was a forgery. He created it to resemble just what the scientists have been looking for. It wasn't real. Look, if the best evidence you have is a forgery, a fraud, a fake, you don't have evidence. What about some of these? We're going to look at some of these ape men that have been in some of the books. According to scientist and author of Icons of Evolution, Jonathan Wells, he says, fakes are coming out of these fossil beds all the time because the fossil dealers know there's big money in it. They're trying to find proof. The picture it writes, a depiction of Nebraska Man, which has been in books, has been in museums. Based on what evidence did we build this entire model of Nebraska Man? There was one tooth that was found in Nebraska. People said, we found a tooth, and this must be a tooth of some primitive man, our ancient ancestor. The only problem was there was an identical tooth that was found attached to the skeleton of a wild pig. And that was in your textbooks in science. Some of you, when you were growing up. What about some of these other ones? You know, images are scary things. They get burnt into your memory. They influence our thinking. Millions of students who have seen Nebraska Man and pictures like this over here of supposed ape men, they've been fed a trough full of propaganda. And sometimes it's taken years, even though people have known for years and even decades that some of these things are false and they've been falsified. It takes years for them to get out of the textbooks. Science is a beneficial study. I don't want anybody to ever think I'm putting down science, but I don't want my kids being lied to about it. And if you keep that stuff in textbooks for years to promote your hypothesis, perhaps scientists need to question whether it's a good hypothesis if what it takes is an evidence of lies to convince us. Here's another ape man. It's Java Man, depicted it right there. He was billed as an ape man who walked erect. It was Homo erectus. You know, you've got this picture that you see of slowly man starts to walk straighter. We'll talk about that a little bit more tonight. Based on what evidence did they make Java Man, this picture you see? Java Man consists, here's what they found. They found a skull cap, a femur, three teeth. Do you see it over there in the corner? That's what this entire depiction, where they try to prove, here's our ancient ancestor. It's a skull cap, a femur, and three teeth, and a whole lot of imagination. And that's our proof that we came from apes. The evolution of man. Piltdown Man was another example of fossil fraud that was in science textbooks. This fossil was used for 40 years. It's in the biology textbook today still that I used this week as I was looking through some of this stuff. This fossil was used for 40 years in textbook as a missing link. Before they learn, the file marks on the orangutan teeth of the lower jaw were clearly visible. Somebody filed this jaw. The molars were misaligned and they were filed at two different angles. If you have to take out the sander to try to make the fossil fit your theory, then maybe you don't have a good example. The canine tooth had been filed down so far, the pulp cavity had been exposed and then plugged. This is a fraud. Archaeopteryx is another one of evolution's famous fossils. Our local biology textbook that's used in high schools today says this: although Darwin recognized the limitations of the fossil record, he predicted the existence of fossils intermediate in form between species. For example, he says there are certain dinosaur fossils that show feathers of modern birds and teeth and bony tails of reptiles. The argument is that, you know, maybe these dinosaurs turned into birds, and so we have a transitional fossil here. Archaeopteryx fossils provide evidence of characteristics that classified as a bird, but also show that the bird retained several distinct dinosaur features. I want to think with you about what Alan Fiducia says. Alan Fiducia is a world authority on birds from the University of North Carolina. He says paleontologists have tried to turn Archaeopteryx into an earthbound feathered dinosaur, but it's not. It's a bird. It's a perching bird, and no amount of paleo babble is going to change that. Archaeopteryx is nothing. It's not proof, says a world authority on birds. Well, hold on. What about all these dating methods? We've got this radiocarbon dating, we've got carbon-14, and we've got all these things. What about all that? Doesn't that prove how old the Earth is, that it's millions and millions of years old? Now, some may argue evolution and older theories, they're grounded in the dating methods of rocks. And many assume the reliability of those radiometric dating methods. But such methods have proven to vary widely in their dating. And those methods begin with assumptions. Let me give you some examples here of how certain rock formations have been misdated. And we know it. For example, Mount Etna, which is in Sicily, not over here where I live. We know that this was a volcano that blew up in 122 BC. When they took Mount Etna, formation from 122 BC, and they dated it with radiometric dating, it dated as 170,000 to 330,000 years old. Do you see that as a problem? I do. Because if it blew up in 122 BC, and that's when the rocks were formed, then we know how old they are. Again, there was another explosion in AD 1972 when they dated that with radiometric dating. It was 210,000 to 490,000 years old. Mount St. Helens, I was a year old when Mount St. Helens blew up. Any of you guys remember that? Yeah. They dated some of the rocks that were formed from the volcanic rocks after the explosion of Mount St. Helens. They dated them up to 2.8 million years old. That was the radiometric date. That's just an airtight process, isn't it? No problems there. Radiometric dating is solid, isn't it? Here's another volcano in Hawaii. Blew up around 1800 to 1801. It dated as 1.3 to 1.7 million years old. Here's another one, New Zealand, from 1954. It dated as 3.5 million years old. Here's another one, Hawaii. But you don't see any of these examples in your textbook, do you? There could be some question that maybe how we're approaching radiocarbon dating and other things like that, or maybe there's some faulty methods there. Bodhi Hodge explains one known problem with the system. He says, if radiometric dating fails to give an accurate date on something of which we do know the truth age, how can it be trusted to give us the correct age for rocks that had no human observers to record when they formed? How can he trust it? There's another alternative. This book, Thousands, Not Billions. If you're really interested in this type of dating, then go read the book. Because I certainly can't explain all these things. But I can tell you what the conclusions they came to. It says, evolutionary models for life, earth, and space are questioned today by a significant group of scientists worldwide. That's not what most evolutionists say. Most of them say, nobody questions this anymore. This is how it is. We've got a pretty airtight case for evolution and how we date rocks and things like that. No, not according to this. Not according to a lot of other scientists. They are convinced that the earth and the entire universe are the result of a supernatural creation event which occurred just thousands of years ago, not billions of years. This book explains some of the fascinating scientific data which supports this recent creation conclusion. Now, you might think, this is just a bunch of preachers that probably wrote this book. No? In 1997, this team sought a fundamental correction to the usual assumptions of deep time. They were skeptical of the evolutionary time scale, which dominates modern geology, and these scientists reviewed the assumptions and procedures used in estimating the ages of rock strata, and they recognized multiple weaknesses. Each of the team members holds an earned doctorate. These are all PhD scientists that have done this research. If you want to read a little bit more about it, some of the chapters that you're going to read there about carbon-14 dating, helium diffusion and zircon crystals, radio halos and granite, fission tracks and zircons, discordant radioisotope dates, radioisotope dating case studies, and theories of accelerated nuclear decay. There's a reason why I'm not explaining all that. Because your eyes would glaze over like they just did for that two sentences that I just gave you. But if you have interest in it, check out the book. At this point, I'm going to say this. Each one of these points today could be an entire lesson. My goal is to throw a few book titles out there and some research that you're never going to hear in a high school or most college classrooms. And I want you to see that there's more than one scientific alternative. This is important for your kids. This is important for kids that have left the church and think that there's no evidence. This is important for your neighbors where you're talking about these particular issues with them. I just want you to see there's more than one alternative when it comes to historical science and the theories that exist. But unfortunately, the one-sided way that science is taught with regard to origins in the classroom leads us to no other way. And that's far from the truth. I'm going to finish with one more picture here. And this is the picture of Haeckel's embryos. Did any of you remember seeing this picture in your science textbooks? I'm glad to say that in our local biology textbook, it's not in there. That's good. Making progress. But I was taught this. I saw this picture. I saw this image when I was in school. My friends, some of them who are no longer believers, they saw this image when they were in school. I want you to realize, again, it's a picture. It's a drawing. It's artwork. I want you to realize this, art is not science. Art doesn't have to resemble real life. Art can be fictionalized. This picture was created by Ernst Haeckel. He was a German biologist. I want you to remember the word German. I want you to think about that for a minute. Because we're going to talk about, when we talk about the fruits of evolution in a couple of weeks, we're going to talk about somebody else who came out of Germany. You know his name, Hitler? Do you realize, you probably don't have to guess, but do you realize some of the things that Hitler believed about man? That there was a less evolved species, and he felt like some of that less evolved species needed to be exterminated. Do you know why he had that idea? Do you know where some of his ideas came from? This guy in Germany, Ernst Haeckel, who lied. He was dubbed the Apostle of Darwinism in Germany. He taught this idea of embryonic recapitulation. It's also called the biogenetic law. His point, which Darwin also argued, was that, and Darwin got his argument, again, borrowing from Haeckel, his argument was that embryos tell us about our animal ancestry. Do you remember being told when you were a student that when you're an embryo, when you're inside of your mother's womb, that you have gill slits, just like a fish? And that proves your evolutionary history, that you probably came from a fish because you have, you know, gill slits. By the way, you know those aren't gills, right? That's actually the growing of your ear and your gland. It's a fold. It's not a gill slit at all. But it sounds a lot better if I'm trying to prove that I've got an animal ancestry and we can see it in the embryo if we use the term gill slits or gills. Might prove that you came from a fish. And that type of comparative embryology, it's still used today as a proof in some textbooks. Here's the problem. Haeckel's handmade pictures, and these are supposed to be pictures of embryos of various animals, they look nothing like the real embryos. Here's the real ones. Here's what a fish looks like when it's an embryo. Here's what a salamander looks like when it's an embryo. Here's what a turtle looks like, and a chicken, and a rabbit, and a human. Back up for a minute. Does that look a little different? It's pictures. Drawings. And they're drawings that were drawn in a certain way to lead people to a certain conclusion. I could say a whole lot more, but here's what I'm going to say about Haeckel. Did you know that Haeckel was convicted of fraud in 1875 by five professors from his own university? At the trial, here's what Haeckel said. This is records from the University of Jena trial. He says, "I should feel utterly condemned were it not that hundreds of the best observers and biologists lie under the same charge." Why is somebody who since 1875 has been convicted of fraud by five professors from his own university, why were his pictures in the textbooks over 100 years later as proof? Again, if that's all you got is some liar's testimony, then you don't have much. Why are those dead arguments being used? Now, why does this matter? We're going to close with this. Because I've been asked this question, why does this matter? Why are all these quotes from these scientists and stuff about evolution, why does this matter? Well, it matters because we need to avoid building on a sand foundation. And this, for a lot of people, this worldview is their foundation in life. A sand foundation, when the storms of life come, and ultimately, when the final judgment comes, a sand foundation is going to fail you. Jesus says, if you hear these sayings of mine and you do them, then when the storms come, your house is going to stand firm. But if you build on the sand, your house is going to fall. Why do we need to talk about this? Because Colossians 2:8 says we need to beware lest anyone cheat you through philosophy. That word philosophy is a pretty broad term. There were certain philosophies that were cheating people when Paul wrote this to Colossae. There are certain philosophies that are cheating people today. What is it today? Some of these philosophies. Beware lest anyone cheat you through philosophy and empty deceit. We're supposed to warn people of how they're being deceived by false teaching. This is one of them. It's not taught from pulpits. Back when my grandfather was preaching, when he was growing up, you know the things that they were preaching about? They were preaching about, you know, we need to believe in baptism is important for salvation. I agree with that. That faith only is wrong. You know why they were teaching those things? Because everybody pretty much believed the Bible. And so the things you had to fight against were simply how people were misunderstanding the Bible. Today, one of the things that we're dealing with more and more when it comes to false philosophy and false teaching are the people who believe in macroevolution, who believe in Darwinian evolution, who believe that we came from apes. Because that's what we've been taught in science, and therefore that's disproven what the Bible teaches about our origin. So we've got to talk about some of these things and fight against some of these things so that people aren't being raised according to the tradition of men, according to the basic principles of the world, so that your belief system is founded on Christ, who believed in a creator who was there at creation. Why do we need to talk about some of these things? Because we're called in 2 Corinthians 10 to cast down arguments in every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. And if that is the professor in your college, if that is the scientist who wears the white coat, if you've got to stand up to that person to cast down their arguments when they're exalting themselves against the knowledge of God so that you can bring every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ, then let's stand for it. That's why we've got to talk about some of these things. That's why some of them are important. Let me finish with this conclusion. I know I've gone on a long time. I thought about switching my sermons. Tonight's is shorter. You'll be glad to know. Some of evolution's strongest, most well-known arguments, they've turned out to be bogus. And yet some have left their faith in God on the basis of many of these false arguments, which were intended to fit the outdated ideology of a scientist who lived over 150 years ago. I'm not sure if we really realize how serious the consequences are. I'm going to give you this example. I want you to revisit the Columbine shooting with me that took place in Colorado several years ago. Dylan Klebold, Eric Harris, killed several of their fellow students before they killed themselves. 13 people died in a school on that day. Bombs were set, guns were shot. 24 people more were injured. The emotional pain from that still lingers. As further information came out about these two boys, here's what we learned. The shooting took place on Hitler's birthday. Did you know that? Both of these boys studied Nazi teaching. They shot one boy, Isaiah, because he was black. They shot one girl because she believed in God. And that gets me, because I think about my kid being in school. And they asked her, "Do you believe in God?" "Yes." After the shooting, you know what the media focused on? "We need more gun control laws to fix this problem." They'd already broken several firearm laws that day. Let me tell you about something that wasn't covered. Do you know what Eric Harris's blood-stained t-shirt said after he killed himself? There's two words on it. Natural selection. Nobody talked about that. These boys didn't need more gun laws. They needed to know God loved them. And they and their classmates were a lot more than just the products of natural processes. And our media needs to start figuring out one of the real problems, a godless society due to the false propaganda of evolution. Once we start figuring that out, changing the hearts of people, we're going to see less Columbines, less Virginia Techs, less abortion clinics being bombed. Less abortion clinics. We need to build on a rock foundation. God gives us that rock in Jesus Christ, He's the Son of God, who came to the world, who proved by many evidences who He was. And we want you today to believe in Him, to realize that you have a purpose in life, and we want you to live for that purpose, to serve God, because He created you, and one day He will judge you. And if you're not ready for that, you need to believe in Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Turn from your sins, because He gives you a purpose and a direction in life. Be baptized into Jesus Christ to start fresh, so your sins can be forgiven, so you can be given new life. And if today you're ready to do that, to start living and proclaiming God in a godless culture, then why don't you come forward while together we stand, while we sing.